somewhat remarkable. It began operations back in February of 2000 from its base at Kennedy Airport. And now, only 7 years later, it serves 50 destinations across the United States and the Caribbean. JetBlue operates a fleet of 99 Airbus A320 aircraft and 25 Embraer 190s. As founder and chairman of the board of JetBlue, David has launched his third successful aviation business and is realizing his desire to bring humanity back to air travel by offering passengers low fares, friendly service, and a high-quality product. David's career in the airline industry began in 1984 when he co-founded a low-fare carrier called Morris Air with June Morris, the owner of Salt Lake City-based travel agency Morris Travel. As president of Morris Air, David implemented the industry's first electronic ticketing system and pioneered a home reservation system that is now the foundation of JetBlue's unique call center. All calls to JetBlue's reservation number are handled by reservationists working out of their homes. Following the sale of Morris Air, David and spent a short period of time with Southwest Airlines, where he took the electronic ticketing system that he had initiated at Morris Air after he left Southwest and developed it into Open Skies, the first world's simplest airline reservation system, and we're all very familiar with that product today. David sold Open Skies to Hewlett-Packard back in 1999. Also during that time period, David acted as a consultant to WestJet Airlines, the successful Canadian low-fare. So you're beginning to see a theme here that all of these successful low-fare carriers around the country, David seems to have been able to touch them at some point in his career. In 1999, after the conclusion of a five-year non-compete agreement with Southwest, and that probably was in Southwest's best interest there to have that non-compete agreement, David decided that the time was right to bring his successful airline formula, that formula of innovative, high-quality service plus low fares equaling a strong and loyal market, to one of the country's largest aviation markets, New York City. He assembled a hand-picked management team of airline industry experts and secured a $130 million capital funding source from investors such as Weston Presidio Capital, George Soros, and Chase Capital, now J.P. Morgan. JetBlue has been ranked the number one in quality and overall performance of U.S. airlines for three consecutive years in the annual airline quality rankings by the University of Nebraska, at the Omaha Aviation Institute, and the W. Frank Barton School of Business at Wichita State University. In addition, JetBlue was also ranked Best Domestic Airline at Condé Nast Traveler's 2006 Reader's Choice Awards. This is the fifth consecutive year in receiving that award. So it's indeed a pleasure this morning to have with us the chairman and founder of JetBlue Airways, David Neeleman. Please welcome David.
Good morning, everyone. Boy, it goes way back there, doesn't it? It's great to be here today. Jim, thank you for that introduction. It was longer than my remarks are actually going to be, so it's great to be a partner at National. Oh, I guess with Dulles Airports. Hopefully we can be at National someday. It's a little boy's dream to fly in and out of National Airport. Aviation pioneer, can't fly at all the airports he wants to fly at. JetBlue, we've been in the press a lot lately. In February, many of you read about the storm and the aftermath of the storm. And, you know, that was certainly a challenging time for JetBlue. And I think sometimes in this business, you get way too much publicity. You get way too much when things are going good, and you get way too much when things are going bad. There's just something about things that fly. There's a fascination with the public and the press. And certainly we were in kind of the center of that storm. It's ironic that the kind of the event that triggered all of the 5 days of troubles that we had in February was a regulatory change from the FAA that didn't allow airlines to fly in ice pellet conditions. And it's something that was put in, and I don't know if that's something to do with global warming or whatever, but we have more ice pellets nowadays. And thankfully, the FAA is reevaluating that whole position, and hopefully we'll have that moderated by this coming winter. Now, that's not to say that we were perfect in every way. Obviously, we had our deficiencies. And many of you know or have heard of Russ Chu, who's our new CLO and is doing a fantastic job. Last month, the board asked me to take a step. There are so many challenges that are facing this industry. The board asked if I would take a step back and be more of a chairman role, spend more time in Washington and spend more time in strategic areas to try and see what we can do to solve some of these big issues. And so, you know, I want to be able to talk about some of those today because I'm passionate about some of the issues that are facing our industry. And we're all in this boat together. None of us can escape it, because I can tell you that it was the grind of what happened in February, the grind that's going to be happening, frankly, this summer, with all of the air traffic control issues we're going to have this summer, ATC delays. It's almost too much to take, really, from our customers. And my fear is that if we don't fix some things in this industry, less people are going to start to fly. I was on the phone with a friend on Sunday night who was leaving out of JFK, not on our airline, but someone else. Delayed, long taxis, just all kinds of issues. This person said, "Why would I fly again? I don't want to fly anymore if I have to go through this every time we fly." And now a lot of you are from smaller airports, obviously, but we all fit together in this community, and we need to work together. I want to talk a little bit first about the ATC system, and certainly there are some things that we need to fix. But kind of at the heart of this is this, kind of in this country, along with when the Constitution was written, if there would have been airplanes, they probably would have talked about the first come, first served rule. And that basically is a rule that allows anyone, if you want to get a plane and you want to buy it, then you're entitled to airspace just as much as a 747 carrying 500 people around. If you're in a Piper Cub, you're entitled to that airspace. And that's great, and that's noble, and it's worked for us for decades in this industry. But obviously, as we move forward, and with the advent of microjets, and you hear these stories of 6,000 more airplanes going to be in the skies with dentists and doctors out flying these things around, we have to create some public policy around where is the capacity. Where's the capacity limit given the technology that we have today? And are we going to continue to throw planes into airspace that is already over capacity based on those people that are going on an ad hoc basis? So obviously, somebody who has a reservation and their flight's been scheduled for a year and people are booked on this flight has the same priority as someone who decides right now to go to a particular place, which is fine. If you're going to an airport that doesn't have congestion or airspace, it's not just going to small airports, but it's also the airspace getting you there and the clogging of these airspace to get there. So we have to think about that. How are we going to do it? How are we going to determine what capacity is? And then what's the mechanism to say you're more than willing to come and fly into this airspace and come to this airport? And if we have space for you, come all day long, but to the extent we're over capacity. Because in this case, in West Palm Beach or Fort Lauderdale or any of these cities, you could, before the FAA made some changes, you could be 3-hour delayed just because everybody decided to take a private jet down on that particular day. So those are policy issues. First come, first served has got to somehow be modified. We've got to figure out a way to not overcapacitate the system, because it will create these abnormal delays on a more frequent basis, and people will begin to choose not to fly. And that is not good for anyone in this room if people choose not to fly. I'm on the MAC also with a couple of my colleagues here, which is the Management Advisory Council for the FAA. And so we're close to the whole technology side and the reauthorization bill that is now kind of before Congress. And, one of the things, airlines are always talking about how they don't want to pay more. We won't pay more, we won't pay more, we won't pay more. Well, I kind of shocked my colleagues when I said, look, it costs me $60 a minute to fly an airplane around. And if I can shave 10 minutes off of every flight, I'll be happy to pay $50 more. Just give me give me where to send the money and we'll pay $50 more. Because if you did have, and this is another kind of a topic that people don't like to talk about, user fee, if somebody actually schedules some time and some airspace and you have to file a flight plan, you know, that from our numbers inside the FAA, tells us it's a cost about $500 or $600 to handle a plane and flight plan. So why not have a $50 fee that we can then bond, which is the Treasury Department's allowed bonding, that we can go raise $10 billion or $15 or $20 billion, whatever it takes for the modernization of the system. We modernize the system, and we don't do it in piecemeal, we don't do it with earmarks, we don't do it with yearly reauthorizations we go out with. As soon as the technology is available, which they're working really hard on, and then we say, okay, this is the plan, everybody bid on it, you're held accountable to it, and we get a new air traffic control system. One of our pilots who does frequent trips into Afghanistan was explaining to me how the air traffic control system in Afghanistan is far superior to the one we have here in the United States. And that's a shame. I mean, everyone is accountable to that. Our Congress is accountable to making sure that we make sure that we get a system that we can, as soon as the technology is available, we need to open up more space so more people can do first come, first serve without being constricted on the airspace. Another big issue obviously facing our industry, and another thing that I'm passionate about and working on, is the fact that our fuel costs have tripled over the years. And this means a lot to our industry as well. Because there's this one of these irrevocable laws of airline economics that the lower the fare, the more people travel. The higher the fare, the less people travel. Does that make sense? It's just one of these irrevocable laws of airline economics. It used to cost us less than $20 to fly someone transcon in fuel. Today it costs us over $70 to fly someone transcon, the fuel portion of that. And that is means that we have to add another $50 onto every ticket. When you do that, less people travel. It's just one of those things. And that's not good for anyone in this room. We have in this country an abundant resource of coal. We've got lots of coal. Coal is something that is really a two-edged sword nowadays. Greenhouse gases are all the rage. It's a big deal. But we are confident, given that we've introduced this bill with Congressman Boucher and Shimkus, and we're meeting with a couple senators to introduce it in the Senate, to create six plants that would have some price support below a certain level and a kind of a windfall tax above a certain level, to take this coal and turn it into jet fuel. It's totally possible to do that. And you can do it with the sequestration of the CO2 with no more greenhouse gases than what you get from a barrel of oil. And you know, some of that technology still needs to be developed on the sequestration of exactly what you did to CO2. If you put it back in solid form and put it back in the ground, or you put it into the ground in certain places. And this bill provides that the sequestration needs to be done and accounted for as part of this bill and as part of the price support for the federal government. But if we could turn, because the issue with diesel is, I remember when I grew up, everybody wanted to own a diesel car because the fuel was cheaper. Because you know, you had this black smoke that went out the back of your car, but it was much, much cheaper. Well, with the advent of kind of clean diesel and the new diesel engines that are in Europe, half of all the cars in Europe are diesel now. And so the prices of distillates have just gone crazy. And you know, that certainly is affecting our, not only the price of oil, but what it takes, the refining portion, which is called the other crack spread. And so by taking a chunk of oil that's in, I mean, coal that's in West Virginia or Illinois or Montana or in any of two-thirds of the states in this country have an abundance of coal, and turning that into jobs in this U.S. and getting rid of our dependence on foreign oil and helping out an industry that really needs it and getting more people to travel so more people will go and in airports and buy from your, park in your garages and buy from your gift shops and buy from restaurants is good for America. So we'll get you some information on House Bill 2208, and hopefully we can get that through. Just in closing, so there's a few things I'm working on that I think are really critical for our industry. And you know, JetBlue is the hallmark of JetBlue is customer service. And I think one of the things that that kind of pains me a little bit is when we have taxi times that are 2 hours and 3 hours because the routes out of town are blocked, and there's many different ways to get out of town, but we need technology to be able to create more flight paths out of town. But we are, it sure helps when you're sitting for that 2 hour taxi out delay and you're sitting there watching 36 channels of TV, you've got a leather seat, you have 36 inches of pitch. I don't know, we kind of are a little bit backwards in our thinking in the industry. Most airlines are putting seats back in airplanes and we're taking seats out. Since we started JetBlue, we've taken 12 seats out of our A320s. So today we have 34-inch pitch in the back and 36-inch pitch in the front, which is 31-inch on 31-32 on regular coach. And so we really believe that if you just take care of people, you treat them well, you give them a great product, you explain things. In the aftermath of February, we created a JetBlue Customer Bill of Rights where our customers have in writing exactly what they're entitled to on all certain cases, so we stand behind our product. Something that is tough to do in an industry where you have so much out of your control. And so that's why this is divided into controllable and uncontrollable. But certainly, on a daily basis, people are receiving credit for flights, for things. Whenever you have over 500 flights a day, obviously there's always something that's going on with, because there's so many moving parts in this business. So we're going to continue to grow. We're going to continue to take care of our customers. We're going to continue to do those things to build a strong company. Because, when you fly in Delta today and you are sitting there and watching TV and somebody comes along with a basket and serves you snacks, that's JetBlue. A lot of what we have done has been transferred to the industry. And, we think we created a better model, and I guess we should be flattered that others are trying to mimic it. And, that's good for this business. It's good for you as airport owners and operators and managers. I guess you don't own them or you wouldn't be here. But as managers, as you're running these airports. So thank you very much. I guess I have a little bit of time for questions if anybody has any questions. Oh, good. Okay. Well, systems. Everything's good. No questions? All right. Well, I'll be here afterwards, and I really do appreciate this opportunity to be here today, and hopefully JetBlue will come to a city near you. I guess one question that you could ask is, you're probably thinking, you just don't want to stand up in a sea of people. What do I think of, you had a lunch speaker yesterday. That Skybus, and how do I think the Skybus model is going to do? Is that good? Should I answer that question? it's interesting. I've certainly watched closely what has transpired in Europe and Ryanair, and certainly I think the point they made yesterday is they're not exactly Ryanair. They have, some things that are a little bit differently, done a little bit different. But all that said, I think air travel, I think in Europe, there was such a vast disparity between what the costs were for kind of the old line incumbent carriers, and the cost difference was so much greater from the Ryanairs and the EasyJets when they came in that it was very, very difficult for those people to compete. It was almost near impossible. And then in the airports that they flew, and kind of the out of the way places, a lot of people flew in Europe that hadn't been accustomed to flying before. It was kind of it was really a good thing for Europe. The U.S. is a different animal, I believe. It's a completely different experience. People have been flying here for a long time, and we're very accustomed to air travel. And we're very accustomed to a certain experience of air travel. And to the extent that someone tries to change radically that experience, you have to hand it to them. But they're trying to do things, and $10 fares are certainly get the attention, even if there's only a certain number on the airplane. But at the end of the day, I think people expect certain things out of their airline. And there are some things maybe perhaps that they've chosen to not have. that they do everything, particularly on the internet. And so, you know, when you look at the routes and you look at the ability to create travel and traffic, and you know, given the fact that the U.S. industry is much more efficient, not the air traffic system, but the airlines and the five major bankruptcies, and the costs are much lower, the disparity between costs are lower, and there's an aggressiveness on the side of these incumbent airlines that is remarkable, and their ability to match fares. And so to the extent that it's in markets where nobody flies, and there's a reason for that, where nobody flies, that's one thing. But when they start getting into other markets, I think there'll be a very aggressive competitive response, like there always has been, like there has been with JetBlue. And then when there's a competitive response and you have the choice of flying this airline or this airline, you're going to go with the airline that gives you the best customer service and the ability to talk to someone on the phone, the ability to reprotect yourself, to do a lot of different things, to not have to claim your baggage even though you're going on the same airline from point A to point B to point C. You know, people express this, a very interesting, I think there may be a correlation here with people express. I've done some forums with Don Burr, and they had a very unique way of doing business. You couldn't get through on the phone there, and you didn't have the internet, so there's a little bit of help there. But what Don said was that we were 80% load factor, making money, until the other airlines matched our fares, and we went to 40% load factor, and we were out of business. And he said we couldn't match their service levels, and so it was very difficult to do it. Now, in JetBlue's case, we get our fares undercut and matched every day, and our load factors are over 80% because we're a preferred product. People love to fly JetBlue because they know they're going to be treated well. So I think maybe there's a little distinction there, and so we'll see how it transpires. It'll be interesting nonetheless. Virgin America, I wonder how they're going to do. I guess I'll close with that. All I can say is nobody's seen kind of the business plan. No one knows where Virgin America is flying today other than JFK, SFO. I can tell you today, given our fuel situation, and Dulles maybe, given our fuel situation, I would hate to have all of our flights be long haul. I would hate it. I mean, JetBlue would certainly not be, our profitability would certainly not be the same. So the long haul business, given the fact that it's more fuel intensive than flying someone short haul, has become very, very difficult and more challenging, and you have to charge a lot more money for it. So it'll be interesting to see how their concept evolves and how much people will pay for it, because that will really will really tell if they'll be successful or not. Question?
Larry Donahue, you said that the People Express was a failure when the legacy carriers matched the fares. And they could not match the service.
Yeah, that was according to the founders. So
I want to tell you, as a passenger today, the service we're getting from the legacy carriers is unmatchable in a different sense.
Right.
I have been abused in every way you can. If I change my seat, I understand they're not starting to charge you if you sit near an exit row. If I change my flight, it's $100. If I want to use my miles and I don't have 14 days, it's $75.
Right.
The only question I want to know is, when are we going to go back to nickel lock on the toilets?
You know, it's a tough industry, I'll tell you that much. It is very tough. You know, I don't know of an industry that when you buy yourself a ticket for $69, and I guess I'm agreeing with you, and I'm kind of defending a little bit the culture that's developed, where you're entitled to have a blankie, a pillow, and bring 100 pounds of your stuff with you, and say, take it with me. Wherever I go, I can haul 100 pounds and expect not to pay any extra money for it. You know, 100 pounds of weight on an airplane costs money. It costs a lot more money than it used to cost. And so I think what, you know, airlines are trying to figure out is what's the right revenue model. You know, how can we, you know, Ryanair's model is they want to charge, give all their seats away in the next 10 years. They want to just charge nothing for their fares and then just nickel and dime you all the way through the process. And charge you for this, charge you for this. Oh, can't bring food on the airplane because we're going to sell you food on the airplane. And so there's a real nickel and dime model over there, and then there's a bunch of people in the middle trying to figure out what the heck to do. But on JetBlue, you're going to be taken care of, and the TV's still free, and you have some great amenities. So come fly with us. Yes, did you have a question? Does that have to do with Reno?
I think we spent a lot of time trying to get you to come to Reno, but the David Neilman I saw today, oh, by the way, I'm Chris Bart, I'm the CEO in Reno. The David Neilman I see today is different than the David Neilman I saw when you first started flying, because today you said you'd be willing to pay that $50 extra. And, you know, when you first started flying, you told us what you were looking for in an airport, and many of us tried to deliver that as we came to visit you and begged you and begged you and begged you over again to bring service to our community. So
shave those mountains around Reno down a little bit.
Well, no, we saw that too. So what we need to know today is, what is it today that you're looking for in an airport that would give you some pause to think about giving service?
It's a good question. I think... And the reason I said I'd pay $50 is because I'm saving $300 in the process. So there's a method to my madness here, which includes an oversight board to make sure that it actually happens. With bonding, because getting funding any other way is treacherous. I think it all starts with cost. I mean, I think I think of some airports that we have decided not to go into because the costs are too high. Some airports that, as the costs have gone up, we're thinking about getting out of. Because the costs are too high. I think that is very important. It really starts with that. When you think about the economic development, I was at a conference. Michael Douglas, the actor, owns a resort off in Bermuda somewhere. I think when they did the inaugural, I wasn't there, and he brought his wife with him, which I've always kind of lamented. But he said, David, since you came to Bermuda, and you've cut those fares, it was $800 to go to Bermuda. It was an hour and a half flight from New York. He said, the business at our hotel is double. He said, it's unbelievable. Because it would, and I said, well, and he said, but it's not JetBlue customers staying there, and there's some of them, but it's mainly all the American customers because they match your fare. So, it's so important to a community, and it creates so much economic value when we come in, that it is something that we need to be able to have good costs, and we have to have a story. I mean, people, it needs to be a market there, obviously. And the lower the fare, the lower the cost, the lower we can charge on the fare, the more people travel, the more successful we're going to be. So, certainly if we look at the market, look at the competition, look at the cost, there are a lot of things that go into it. Thank you. All right, thanks everybody.